Thursday, April 6th, 2023. It is 11:43 a.m. On a beautiful sunny Santa Fe day. I'm sitting here with Christina Pink. We are going to do an oral history interview for the Rick Dillingham retrospective at the New Mexico Museum of Art titled To Make, Unmake, and Make Again. The exhibition will be open from October 6th, 2023 until June 24th, 2024. And Christina will be speaking about her memories of Rick Dillingham, Rick's work, their work together, and probably some more. So I'll turn it over to Christina.
Hi.
Oh, squeaky. So Christina, the first question. When and how did you meet Rick Dillingham?
I met him at the UNM art department, the ceramics department. And that was, I believe, in 1970 or 71. I had just come to UNM, and he hadn't been there for long, I know. And I was also in the art department along with Rick, but this was my first foray into ceramics, so I didn't know anything about it. And I had always, I'd spent a lot of time as a teenager and a child in New Mexico. We didn't live here early on, but my family had been coming here since 1949. And my mom had worked, when we did move here, my mom had worked for Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Development, New Mexico Magazine. She was a writer. So there was a lot of history involved, and I was exposed to a lot of Southwestern Pueblo pottery early on, and always loved it. And so when I got into join the ceramics department, I wasn't terribly interested nor terribly good at wheel throwing, but was fascinated because I had learned that they did everything by coil, and it was so, I just marveled at their work. And and when I met Rick, it was perfect because he knew everything about it, and or was learning still. But just he continued my fascination with it, you know, and I wasn't even familiar with his own work at that point. But so he taught me everything I knew about ceramics, slab and coil building and slips and he was just beginning his gas can era and experimenting with dung firing, and he was learning about it too. So it was fun to see him learn as our relationship, kind of our friendship progressed. And you know, we would go to firings at various pueblos, and it was great to see him learning too, and I could just always see the wheels turning, you know. Sorry, I'm getting carried and getting off track.
You don't need to worry about that.
You know, but again, anywhere from dung firing to raku, all of that was just, it was, and then using regular firings, I guess. It was all an experiment. It was all exciting. He was incredibly innovative. And I'd never really known anyone who was so focused like him. We were just in our early 20s, and that was an era where people weren't. People were more relaxed and not career oriented. You know, hippie people were just becoming hippies and going in the opposite directions that Rick did, you know? And he was just driven. And if he wasn't working, if he wasn't down in the ceramics department, and I'd go down there with him, because if I wasn't working or in class, I was spending most of my time with him. It was just really easy. It was an easy friendship, which was really nice. It was, you know, those few friendships you find in life where you just fall into it, and you can talk about anything right away. Or some friends you have, you can never talk about anything, you know. you know what I mean, in terms of intimacy and just from the heart right away. So, and he had a wicked sense of humor. Sarcastic, dry wit, yeah. It was good.
So, what is or what was the nature of your relationship with Rick? And you've already talked a little bit about like your friendship and how easy things were. Could you talk a little bit more about that? And like what did, how you two bonded and how that relationship developed?
Well, we, again, ceramics and through Southwestern, the Pueblo pottery. He lived over on Columbia, and I was in the same kind of complex, horseshoe-shaped complex. And so it was really easy. I'd just go over to his place and knock on the door. And when we were out of the apartment, we were always doing some stuff. But when we were in the apartment, that was the one time when we could just talk. And I would be looking at his collections. He had a lot of the Pueblo pottery there, and he had his bedroom closet was absolutely stuffed with San Ildefonso's Maria Martinez. I mean, I was afraid to open the door, you know, because something would fall out or whatever. Wrapped, of course, but that was the time. You know, he'd make lunch and or dinner, and we drank beer and wine, and he had the. People always bring up the micaceous pottery he had, the utilitarian Pueblo pottery, you know, he mm-hmm. used exclusively to make his New Mexico chili or various dishes. I've forgotten, Maurice brought up sopa de albóndigas, you know. But we'd sit and drink and talk, and first about the pottery and what he was doing. Himself, direction, he wasn't sure which direction he was going to with anything, and in some ways I knew New Mexico better itself as far as the geography and topography, because again, because of my mom, and she loved the history, and for her writing for New Mexico magazine or other things, that she would take me to places that nobody else went to. And and Rick loved doing that, stuff like that. It was so easy. It's even hard to remember. There wasn't anything really specific. He'd talk about his work. Again, he wasn't sure where he was going. Sometimes he'd be working on something at the ceramics department and think, well, let's try this, or let me, you know, I want to try a different idea, or. And just try it and do it, you know. When he was just beginning to develop his relationships with the Pueblos, and within a few years it seemed like he knew everybody, you know. When we would go to a firing, and or like Maria Martinez and her that's what we were talking about, Popovida, her son. And I can't remember if Tony was there or not, or Tony, how old Tony would have been. Not Tony Martinez, but Tony Da. I had never been, you know, I knew what a privilege it was. I didn't quite know how famous she was becoming, but I knew what a privilege it was to be Anglo and to be invited to a firing in the wee hours of the morning, you know, when the wind is low, and cow dung, corrugated metal, you know, sheet metal, and then the wood, pine something or other, I can't remember. But just how the firing went and how they regulated it and how they, just everything. It was a huge privilege to be there. And Rick was learning too, you know, because I remember talking, every person who threw pots on any of the Pueblos, they had their own clay source. And that was, you know, they didn't talk about where it was, but they had their own clay source. And, you know, as the ground changes, of course, the clay is different. The slips are different. Rick had showed me how to, you know, burnish with a spoon, and he had favorite spoons, but they were using stones, you know, and they had their favorite stones, but just, it was so exciting, and it was, to me, it was historic, to me, it was, and just, I felt like I, you know, the first Anglo to be, like, some of the Taos Six must have felt when they were first, had access to the Pueblos in the early 1900s, that they were the first ones to be allowed in, you know, like Edith Warner at Odowee Bridge, who, you know, was allowed onto the San Ildefonso Pueblo. I mean, those kinds of privileges were, it wasn't commonplace. It was something really special still to me back then. I think I had, see, I'm getting sidetracked again. We had, like, every time we would go up there, well, we'd have a whole day, like on a Saturday or Sunday, and we'd go to San Ildefonso or Santo Domingo before we started going out of state to Acoma in Arizona. And we would, we'd have, he'd have made arrangements prior to that, and the whole while, and I didn't kind of even realize at that point he was starting to register all the information about the families themselves, and that would eventually become the seven families and then the 14 families books. But talking to the whole family would be there, and we'd eat lunch, and he was always incredibly respectful and asking them questions and not trying to pry. And they were getting to know each other also. And sometimes he'd bring something, a pot, or he would show them. I know Maria eventually had some of his pots, I think. So it was a really good, they knew that he would do right by them. I think they got that sense, or whatever this turned into, he would always do right by them and respect everything about their culture, their work, them as people, you know, just as individuals. And then again, he had a good sense of humor, and so did they, some, you know. but some of my favorite times were, if not in the apartment, because that was alone time and that was downtime, talking about, again, at work, the Pueblos, and later on, as we got to know each other, his own sexuality and how much angst he had with all of that kind of beginning to come to the forefront. The other time that I so enjoyed, that I've mentioned to you before, is at so many of the Pueblos, you know, when they just discarded broken pots, they toss them and they wind up in the riverbeds, and or some of the mesa, Hopi mesas that had actually old previous villages built on lower ground, and, you know, just pots, archaeological sites. I mean, that's what they were, and shards all over the place. And so Rick would always ask for permission, and sometimes someone would come with us, one of the family members that he was friends with, and sometimes they just let us loose by ourselves, and we'd spend hours just walking, and we could talk while we were walking and looking for shards. You know, I always had this, I think I lived in a fantasy world sometimes. I felt like I was the first white person. That was sacred land. Whites weren't allowed out there without specific permission, you know, and back then that was, it was still foreign. It was still much more so than it is now. That's the feeling that I get. And I was very incredibly privileged to be allowed out there to walk. And you felt kind of like it was your first footsteps, you know, could have been those riverbeds. And we found a ton of shards. And back then they weren't, now you almost have to register, you know, every time you turn around, you've got to register or file a claim or do this and this and this. And back then it wasn't. And there were so many that we both took some. I know he took a lot more than I did, but and I still have some pieces. And I found a piece of drill turquoise once, which was, he was very jealous. But he took it to the university. It was a triangular shape with a little hole in it. Mm-hmm. And he took it to the university and they analyzed it being at least 500 years old. And I put it into a necklace in a heishi. I had it made. Unfortunately, years later, it was stolen. But that was really exciting. And at that, the day that I found that was near Santo Domingo. And there was, and I don't remember the names, because this is, you know, over 40 years ago. But someone was with us, and he said I could keep it. You know, we had everything that we had that we kept. We'd had permission. Mm-hmm. And he was always incredibly good about that. I think those, being in his apartment and being those times that we could walk, because it was just those glorious summer skies with the clouds, and it was just relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, he wasn't thinking, I don't think he was thinking so much about work. So, and should I just go on, or do you want to try to corral me?
No. I mean, you, if this is bringing up new memories, like, you should feel free to go on, for sure.
One other place we used to go to, which was in Albuquerque. You know, you don't have any money when you're 20, 22 or so. So I had worked in a restaurant in Old Town called Inde Oude Heden, which was a Dutch restaurant of all things. and they never had a lot of people in it, but I loved the building. It was a historic, of course, everything was historic down there. And I would take Rick there, and Rick loved to go. And we'd go there a lot because I could get a discount and just sit there forever. And we could, you know, drink beer or wine and eat. And it was cheap because, again, the discount. It's crucial. Because he never had an 8-to-5. I mean, he never seemed to have a regular job. And I don't know if we ever talked about it. We must somehow, I don't know how he funded his school. I don't remember. I was working at nights, or after classes. Or maybe he just sold some of his work. Maybe he was beginning to trade. I know that was part of it. Mm-hmm. Eventually, there were people that wanted to go into business with him, I know, in Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. But so those meals at Inde Oude Heden were... that was fun. It was great to go out, you know, that was special. And shortly after, we had known each other very long, when he'd start making trips into more southern New Mexico, and then across New Mexico and into Arizona, and invite me to come. And so we would just take camping gear, and not much, because we had to save all the room in the van for cow shit, cow pies, excuse me. And he was always looking forward to Arizona cow pies, because they were denser, apparently. Whatever the cows ate in Arizona was better cow pies. They stayed together. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we'd be at the pueblos and firing, and some of the, you know, the cow pies would just crumble or whatever, and it was harder to manage them, I guess. And Arizona cow pies were much better. So we would strike, you know, go forward and in the van, and with as little camping gear as possible. So there's a lot of room for cow pies, and we would just stop along the highway. That was the old Route 66, I guess. You know, crawl under the barbed wire kind of thing, and when we see cows, and go out there and walk around the herds. We never got stopped, no one ever came along and said, you know, get off my property or anything. And collect as many as we could, and stack them up or in the back of the van. And several times by the time we'd get to the California border, you know, at Needles, the fruit and plant guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was always summer, so the windows were down anyway. And we'd been driving with that smell. We didn't even notice it. But boy, did they notice it, you know, and Rick would have. And, you know, Rick had the beard, of course. And not work shirt, blue work shirt and jeans, his uniform. And they'd make us get out and ask us questions and make him open up the van and go into great detail about how, you know, he was an artist and he used them for, I don't know if they bought it, but they, the cow pies were dry enough, obviously. They weren't really disgusting, but they weren't going to go any further, you know. They weren't going to, so they let us through. And no contraband, I guess. And, you know, and there may have been, because the other thing we collected was roadkill. But we didn't collect the carcasses. And it was not, you know, it wasn't like coyotes or anything. It was birds, so that he could use the feathers for his work, his own work. And just in case he, you know, hadn't started using feathers at that point, or was just beginning to, but any feather that we found that was in decent shape, he was very respectful of the bird. He'd move it to the side of the road and, you know, probably said a little Indian prayer over it or something, and pluck very carefully. But sometimes there was a little matter attached to the feathers, you know, and those would, in that hot 100 degree heat. So I can imagine how it smelled when we opened up the van. But one time we went to, and I've forgotten how to, is it Cal Rieger or Rieger?
Rieger.
Rieger, that's what I thought. Yeah. He was having a workshop on the Colorado River. And I'd never done anything like that, to actually dig the clay mm-hmm. out of the riverbed. And there were only about 15, 20 people there, max. Mm-hmm. And it was about 105 degrees or 10, and a hot wind blowing. And that spot, I don't know if you've ever been there, there's an astounding, really short mountain range that is so extraterrestrial looking in shape. Mm. And just the juxtaposition of this incredibly arid moonscape, and then this river, I mean, wide river too, you know, going through it. And even when you're half a mile away, you can smell the water. And it was such a strong memory when we were getting close to it and then seeing these shapes of these mountains. I don't know what the range is called, but so we were there for a few days, and we were digging clay, and we just camping out. Helen, he was close with Hal, so I mean they were talking a lot. But we had to build pots in about 5 minutes because it was so hot, and with that hot wind, that everything would just crack. You know, if we didn't, I still have a pot at home, the very first one I ever did. And I have some photos of it. Do you, if you want to see them now or later?
Later, now, okay. Whatever you want. Yeah.
I'll show you. Let's see. I took them this morning, actually, because, I just didn't know what you'd want to see.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed it has survived all these years. It hasn't been broken or tiny. I mean, it's only this big, like the old wedding pots with the two holes, mm-hmm. you know. And again, you had about maybe 5 minutes mm-hmm. to do it. Oops, sorry.
You're fine.
So.
Oh my gosh.
So that was the first and only, mm-hmm. actually, that I kept. Mm-hmm. But notice, so we dung fired them, but this is just the clay. Mm-hmm. Which had that beautiful pink, you know, soft mm-hmm. pink kind of.
Wow.
Again, that's why it's really rough.
Yeah.
And it's heavy. It's way too heavy than it should be as far as good technique.
Wow.
I think I can't remember if you did it too thin, it just cracked immediately. but that's it. But that I'm happy that survived.
Would you be willing to send those to me? Could you email me sure. a photo or two, and I'll attach them to your transcript?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I better write it down.
No worries.
Memory a minute long.
Mine too.
Oh no, you're not yeah, that. You're not that old yet. So that was, it was really fun to actually dig the clay.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that very distinctly, and being in that water and that heat.
Mm. Something else.
Yeah. That was the only workshop we went to, but we would, we would go to, and I always thought it was the first Mesa. Was it the third with the, Walpi or the, that's where I met Fanny Nampeo.
Malpai. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first Mesa or third? For some reason, I read somewhere that it was the third. And I thought, well, no, I thought it was the first.
It must be the first because he used to, I heard from someone
mm-hmm.
that he used to talk about how he didn't like going over the second Mesa.
Yeah, I believe that.
And then I feel like that might just be him trash talking because he went to Arizona all the time. But...
But I can believe that. I can mm-hmm. believe that. But we... I'm backing away from...
I know, it's really scary.
It's not scary, it's just... It's
a lot.
It's intrusive.
It is intrusive. So I apologize.
It's that... Whatever, the parameter that mm-hmm. we have, 3 feet or something around
yeah.
us. Yeah, we went to... Of course, everything had been arranged. And... I met Fanny Nampeo and her daughters. They were all working in pottery. And she was really lovely. And I didn't know anything about her mother. Mm-hmm. Who's Nampeo, at that point? Mm-hmm. And sometimes Rick was not forthcoming in my education before we got somewhere, As I was there, I began to realize when I got a pot from her and he... educated me on how to look at them and what everything meant on it, and she was standing there, there were quite a few pots in her house, I remember, and I again it was that I just oh my god I can't believe I'm here feeling that privileged, and he was so relaxed with them, and they were with him, and easy and a lot of respect back and forth, and I just felt incredibly grateful to be along for the ride. I'd always just kind of stand to the side or in back of him or wherever mm-hmm. and observe, mm-hmm. And then we'd have, great chili lunches. And I always, the obligatory Jell-O and Coke, always like the colors and the Jell-O bouncing around, mm-hmm. And Coca-Cola, it was relaxed. It was always, he was never in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
He was never, and which was kind of nice to see because he was so driven and focused going at home. I mean, in Albuquerque and doing things all the time, but when he was on the Pueblos, he was on their time and he knew it. And he was going to take any time that they gave him, And at that point, I don't ever remember him really writing things down unless he did it later on when I wasn't in his presence or something about, Fanny, birth date, mm-hmm. Her daughters, mm-hmm. what I mean? Beginning to record that history.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Acoma, we'd go to Acoma, mm-hmm. Lucy Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, just absorbing it all and writing it down later. I don't know how that, we never really talked about that.
Yeah. We have his notebooks here.
Oh, okay. So he did write
a little bit.
Okay.
But I think a lot of it was just up here.
Just, yeah. It just seemed like it, which is, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it's like doing that. I told you that I and spent 4 years photographing Patricia LaFarge's Latin American textile mm-hmm. collection. Mm-hmm. 60 years, yeah. just in her head.
Yeah.
You know? Some people can, yeah.
Some people got it.
Yep. yeah, but the same thing. Just, he would absorb everything. And I can just see his face. You know what I mean? His expressions. And those were heady times. And then, well, of course, if we could, if they'd allow us to, then after that was all over at the end, then we'd go look for pot shards, you know, mm-hmm. down below the mesa or wherever, or just walking around and with whatever time was daylight was left or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, more cow shit and cow pies and roadkill. Yeah. So the trips were always successful when we came back. And you'd really felt like you'd been on an adventure, you know, and to driving those dirt roads in Arizona and in that van. He had he'd wear a bandana or a scarf around his neck. And we had to have used maps or something. Or he just knew. We'd just go, mm-hmm. you know. We'd just go. And he'd, and those times I think in the van too, and on those trips when we were in forced confinement, he would talk, you know. And it was always just really easy. I never gave it a second thought. That you have those friends that you can open up to mm-hmm. quickly, and they are friends for life. And you can always open up no matter how long it's been that you haven't seen them. You haven't. It's just the nature of that connection.
Yeah.
And that's what he was for me. And judging by some of his letters to me, I read one of them this morning. And when I was in Europe, and we were still writing, he could open up to me too. So that was really nice. When he'd say, I've never written a letter like this before. He said, I didn't even know I could do it. But but you know how it's easier to talk to some people sometimes when the people aren't there, when they're either a stranger or they're either just not there in a letter because mm-hmm. there's that distance. And he needed to talk about all the issues he was having with coming out. He still liked women, couldn't figure him out. But he was very interested in men. And, you know, I don't know what his parents did. I mean, I don't. But it's sad. So, not that it's always your parents' fault, but their attitudes were. It's their loss. You know, it really is. So,
I feel like you've addressed a lot of these
questions
so far, but we can keep going. I guess like you've talked a lot about like how you would describe him. You've described him very accurately. Is there anything that you can think of that like you missed just in the description that you've given us so far?
No, but one thing I mentioned earlier that he had a really nice relationship with my mom, and she lived up in the Sandia Mountains, Cedar Crest, Sandia Park, and again, she was a writer, and you know, when I was growing up in Los Angeles with her, our house was always full of artists and painters and flamenco dancers and gay retired military people. I mean, just everybody. And I took him up to, they met in a bar, it was called Willie's, which was really popular up off I-14, the road going up to the crest, you know, back then. And that's where everybody kind of, that was the meeting place. And And I hadn't, you know, I knew that they would enjoy each other, but I never knew that it would go, I mean, that it would continue, the relationship would continue, because he would write to me about, oh, I went up to Willie's, I, you know, saw your mom last weekend, or she called me, or, and my mom would write to me too when I was mm-hmm. overseas. And so that was a whole aspect of his personality that I hadn't known. That he had a lot of, well, like Billy Walters and a lot of people that were older could be kind of mother figures or parental figures, but he really sought her out. And that was, I really enjoyed that. That was, well, to me, it was like kind of like a compliment to me and to her, mm-hmm. and that they enjoyed that relationship. Mm-hmm. Just a kind of a part of his personality that I hadn't seen yet. And I saw it a little bit when as it turned out, when I had gone to Highlands University before UNM, I had had a long relationship with Billy Walter's son, Kurt, and you know how that's, it's also incestuous. Yeah. And then I met Billy through Rick, you know, I think. I don't think I'd met her before, but yeah, so it was, that was, so, but he... Wow. He had a really nice relationship with her too that I remembered. Mm-hmm. I mean, and at least I didn't see her often, but he pursued it after I left, which was really nice. He continued that relationship with my mom. She had, I mean, as I had mentioned, she was friends with a lot of my friends because mm-hmm. she was very progressive and creative and bohemian and all those things that most kids' parents weren't back then. Mm-hmm.
And could you, just for the record, could you state your mother's name just so that we have it in the audio?
Ellie Phillips.
Awesome.
Yeah.
E-L-L-I-E.
Yeah. And I don't know if I mentioned, I'm Christina Phillips Pink legally. Rick knew me as Phillips. And Pink was a married name that I just attached. So
just tack it on.
Yeah. And... it's too long, so I just Christina Pink. I like being a color too.
Yeah, it is. It is fun. And pink's a good color. And I feel like we've already talked about the fourth question and like what you remember most vividly about him. But do you want to add anything since we're here?
Let me see if I wrote anything that I was trying not to forget. Not here. I mean, because a lot of what we did was, it was repetition.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have money to go out and do, I mean, we had a restaurant we went to, we were in the ceramics department, mm-hmm. or we were driving to Pueblos or, you know, yeah. that kind of thing. Which was plenty for me. I mean, that was great. I didn't do that with anybody else.
Yeah.
And I think we had a new dimension of my friendship opened up with him after I left New Mexico, because I wasn't nearly as focused as he was. And I knew that I would always be involved in the arts at some point, but I was more involved in drawing and painting into it. And didn't want to go the route of the poor starving artist because I'd grown up with that, and but wasn't sure where, but I knew I wanted to travel. And so when I left and went to Boston for a couple of years, we still continued to write. I was working in ceramics there because it was so much more limiting living in downtown Boston, mm-hmm. you know, but using a sling and coiling pots. I made some nice ones too, but they were given away, and who knows if they're still alive anywhere. And then when I went to Europe and I was working there, and then Asia and South Pacific, and we continued to write, and that just because people wrote back then, mm-hmm. and writing takes longer than emails, and you know, it's a whole different situation, different scenario, and I kind of miss that. You get letters in the mail. Tactile aspects of the paper, people's mm-hmm. writing, but that that opened up a new dimension, because obviously we hadn't written when I was living here. Mm-hmm. And so, and the fact that he took the time to sit down and write, mm-hmm. and long, like, you know, letters, pages, mm-hmm. and really delve into his own heart. And again, sometimes with that, even though we were really close, there was still, when you're going deeper and deeper, to have a little distance allows you to do that. You know, it's more comfortable when the person is further away physically or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it was a whole, for both of us to write. And I mean, you have a few letters here, which are not real deep when I read them. I went down and read them last year or year before. But I remember writing some others, maybe, you know, who knows if he kept them or not. But that opened up a different aspect of both of our personalities in the relationship we had. So, and that continued until, well, for several years, we were still writing when I was in New Zealand, and then, but when I went, trying to remember the time frames, I lost touch with him when I had to go back to the States for a family illness. And back then, you know, well, there were no computers. There were no computers. And or the ones, the computers that there were, you know, you couldn't do a search for someone. And I got caught up in my own life, married my husband to be, we moved to the Bay Area. The couple of trips back to New Mexico, then I was working so much, you know, I'd come back for 2 days and I'd ask around, and nobody else I knew Rick, and then, oh yeah, well, he's in Santa Fe. And then I thought, I have to come back. And then I heard he got sick, he was sick. And I knew what that meant, having been in San Francisco a lot. And I thought, well, the next time I come back, I've got to go see him. And then it was too late. I didn't realize how advanced it was already. And they didn't have the cocktails back then or anything like that. That was all just beginning. Another few years, he would have been okay, you know. But for that reason, I really look forward to meeting. Is it Juliet? I've heard so much about her.
Yeah.
You know, just because I know, see that other side, if she's willing to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. She's very
closed
about it.
But protective.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
And, but I hope, well, maybe.
You'll meet her.
Yeah.
You will.
And it would, I mean, even with what little I can offer to this exhibit, it was hard for me to, it's mine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what I have of Rick. Mm-hmm. I don't want to let it, but then you realize that letting it out there isn't going to take it away from you. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
It's that's hard though.
Yeah. Mourning and grief, it's weird.
yeah, and it could just go on. It's like you haven't thought about it in a long time, and then suddenly, oh, this is really bringing it back.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah.
I even just, I'm trying not to get emotional. But
you can be emotional, it's okay.
Oh, I don't want to, though. yeah, just since the day that Maurice called me, because I was working, my colleague with the photography thing I've worked on with Patricia Lafarge. Turns out I've been working with her for a year or two, and I discovered that I mentioned Rick's name one day. Mm-hmm. She said, Rick Dillingham, well, I have a good friend who's writing a biography on him. You've got to meet Maurice. And Maurice called, and we spent some time together at his house and et cetera, talking about Rick. And and ever since then, it's just like all this stuff has come back up about Rick. Mm. That was very safe and tucked away, very nice and tidy, for a long, long time.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's your fault. It's your fault, Katie. And now, yeah, it just wells up and you don't even realize that it's still there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when you really love someone, and I'm not just talking about heterosexual, you know, but it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. So, any rate, yeah. Sorry.
You don't need to be sorry. That's fine.
But
same needs to be said.
I'm thrilled. I'm so I feel so fortunate to have known him and for us to have had the relationship that we had. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, very sorry that I didn't see him. But I hope that I'm ecstatic that you all are having this exhibit. I think it's needed. It's so well deserved. I didn't realize it was going on till June too, which is great. Opens on my birthday. John, yay. And 2 days after yours, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a nice birthday present for both of us.
Yeah. We'll be open for Pride in 2024.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot. And then I hope, you know, and I'm happy to, I've seen some of the pots that are coming from private donations, from museum here and there. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, Rick's work has been validated, you know, the V&A Museum, the Smithsonian, he's been recognized in a lot of places and that he should be in. But I hope this continues the interest in his work and sparks new interest. Mm-hmm. And he is so deserving, I mean, not only of his own work, but, you know, recognition, further recognition of what he's done for the Pueblo pottery, Southwestern Pueblo pottery. Yeah. History and the families and that, you know, I don't know if Maurice's biography will go forward, and I think it would be great. No, thank you. I think it'd be great if it sparked an interest in some kind of sponsorship for him, you know, and because I think Rick is deserving of a book.
Yeah,
I really do.
Well, off the record,
yeah.
There is a new scholarship happening at the doctoral level on Rick's work. And I'm speaking with a PhD student tomorrow who is dissertating on Rick. And I don't know how exclusively about Rick the dissertation mm-hmm. will be, but I'm gonna find out tomorrow. So
Yeah.
So I'll let you know what the outcome of that is.
That would be great. I do hope that that's fantastic. I also hope in the back of my mind though that because Maurice has spent years on this,
yes.
what he's written,
yes.
that isn't lost or.
Formed. I don't think so. You know? I don't think it will be.
Even if we've talked about him editing it, mm-hmm. and
he will be writing. Something for El Palacio.
Yes, that's what I've talked to him a few times. He says
I think he's whittling it down to 5,000 words.
Yeah, I know. He's been talking about it for months. And that's his, because I had seen a good really good documentary on the playwright, black playwright August Wilson. Mm-hmm. But it was from the perspective of not his entire life, didn't have every minute of his life, from the of course, he died so young and wrote 10 great plays or so that, but it's a class that they get high school students involved in every year. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with that,
yeah.
and they do a monologue, they pick their own play, do the monologue, and whoever wins gets to be on Broadway. And I called up Maurice and I was so excited. And I said, look, this is what is so great, because only in that hour long documentary, they only mentioned that, you know, he died of cancer at like 60 or something, 62. And, but they only mentioned that once or twice. That wasn't the focus. The focus mm-hmm. was his work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it's been expressed that Maurice goes into such detail with his personal life, which is tragic at the end, that it's too much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to me, to do justice to Rick and his life and his work and the work he did for the mm-hmm. Pueblo families. Even that alone, you can have a little epilogue that may allude to some of his personal life, but you don't have to have.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's just, that rough. Breaks my heart.
It is heartbreaking.
He so wanted a relationship for so long and didn't know how to go about it, didn't know how to do it, didn't know how yeah. to find it, didn't know what he wanted to find.
Yeah.
And then he got it. You know.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, see, we don't, you don't have to have every minute. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping, and I kind of nagged him. Please don't. I just think it's so important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a window of opportunity with those things. Mm-hmm. I said, even put it aside for a while. Well, don't think about it, but don't let it collect too much dust.
Mm-hmm. I think the window is opening right now with this show.
And that's and what with... I'm, yes, yes. I'm so, cause this, the buzz will be around it.
Well, and I think the buzz already is around it.
Great.
You know, you were mentioning this sense of these emotions and memories coming back up to the surface, and that these conversations happening like around you sort of inciting this remembrance experience that you're having, and you know, re-experiencing some grief and some sadness, but also remembering him and mm-hmm. the work,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I guess back on the record.
Yeah.
I guess like then my last question for you before we wrap up is, how did you see Rick's personality manifesting itself in his artwork and in his work? Or his scholarly practice. And I think you talked a little bit about how he was on the Pueblo and how he shifted his sense of time and mm-hmm. Approached everyone with respect and practiced a lot of listening. Mm-hmm. But you were also with him in the art studio and in mm-hmm. these in the workshop with Hal Rieger. And how did you see his personality in the studio space?
I think if anything, it's just his humor, which was some what could be sarcastic and fun and always appreciated. Well, most of the time at least. But
everyone's a critic.
But he it was the quirkiness kind of sometimes in his humor, or he'd be working and, well, let's try this or that, or again, just looking at the when I was looking at the photographs of all the evolution of the gas cans. And you saw not only just the bold color, all one color, suddenly from these really soft muted, it was like he was beginning to come out in his own personality and showing that in color, showing that in the weird, funny shapes that he was doing, showing that maybe if you attached a feather or did that, I mean, all these things were, you know, people hadn't done these things back then. Mm-hmm. So maybe that doesn't sound like much, but I could see you know, there weren't marked differences so much at that point. Mm-hmm. But just his personality was evolving and he wasn't sure where it was going. And so did were his pots. Mm-hmm. And as he was working on them, he would, well, let's try, maybe I could try this, or let's do this a little longer, or do this a little, you know, more saturated, or do, you know, maybe I can think about when we do, if we do it with dung, we can do it so there's some coloration around the lip, or, you know, just trying to always pushing the envelope and, but not necessarily knew where he was going. Mm-hmm. And that to me was his personality too, mm-hmm. pushing himself and then some of the quirkiness coming out, you know, with the shape, funny shapes or that look, you know, if not prehistoric, then Martian-like, you know? And I always found it interesting, his work next to the Pueblo pottery, because that was so exacting, the Pueblo pottery and the shapes. And they did such an incredible job when they did their coil work. You know, you couldn't believe it could be so uniform. and the painting on it, and the and then his was just so different sometimes, and it was kind of refined and crude at the same time, and then the really subtle raku glazes, and with the juxtaposition of that with a gas can, you know, and this something that was ancient and again refined, that I think of raku as more maybe just the age of the process. It's been around for so long. But all, yeah, those are all aspects of his character and his personality, mm-hmm. right next to each other, you know, fighting for front space, you know what I mean? Front row. And developing. He was only 20. Mm-hmm. And what he did in 20 years was pretty remarkable, I think. Not just because I knew him, but, you know, really remarkable what he did on both of those planes. It's his own work and with the Native Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've never talked to anyone. I don't know. I've never known any of them well enough to have that kind of conversation, mm-hmm. or that knew Rick. Like, what it, you know, it would be nice to get a perspective from the people that actually were dealing with him back then, from the Lewis family or from the Nampeo family or from what they thought of him. This, yeah. How this guy showed up one day and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, with his beard.
Yeah, with a beard, exactly, with a big burly beard.
This guy with a beard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see him coming a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So. Wow. Yeah, so I'm really excited about this, and I thank you and everybody. I know it's a huge endeavor, and it must be amazing just to suddenly one day, oh my God, there's a video of him. You know, you've got this opportunity, these little things, that little gifts that creep in. It's your phone.
I'm getting a phone call from Chicago.
Ah.
I will call them back.
And you have an appointment where, well.
We're good. Well, is there anything else that you want to add or that you want us to know before we wrap up?
I can't think of anything right now. I hope I haven't just been long-winded.
No, this is all incredibly valuable.
You know, you probably say that to everyone.
No, I'm serious. Well, because it is incredibly valuable. It's you know, we're filling in all of these missing pieces.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, we don't have him here with us.
Yeah.
To do that work. So it's really been kind of, and everybody that knew mm-hmm. Rick has a different piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So really this is incredibly valuable. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. And have you figured out that you were,
sorry.
you were talking last time about, you hadn't quite figured out how to do this audio part.
Yeah.
And have you, has that developed any further?
Yes.
Or?
We're going to have QR codes in the gallery. And so people will be able to like take their phone and scan the QR code, and it'll pull up the audio so that they can listen in the gallery.
So they listen through their...
They'll listen through their personal device.
Okay.
Instead of having headphones, because then you can walk around, you have
you can
some
walk
mobility,
around
and you can listen and see the work.
Which is great.
Yes.
And also it satisfies that COVID aspect.
Yes.
Yeah, which, oh, yes. That's fantastic.
And there will be, for anyone that's hard of hearing, there will also be a transcript mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
So they'll be able to read if they can't hear.
Now, one thing I would be thinking of is that it'd be nice if people could bring earplugs or something, just so that it wouldn't, because, you know, when you're standing there, you don't necessarily want to hear someone else's phone
mm-hmm.
talking
mm-hmm.
if you're looking at a piece. And if a lot of people are listening.
Yeah. Then.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. It's the first time that we've done anything like this.
Yeah, sounds great. So, like a great idea.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
We might have to add a little extra, like turn down your phone volume or please don't listen on speaker. Something there. But that's actually a really good potential hiccup to think about.
I just remember, I mean, I always encourage people when they go to any exhibit, whether it's Georgia O'Keeffe or Alcatraz,
mm-hmm.
get the tape tour, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know,
the audio guide,
the audio guide and walk through.
Mm-hmm.
I said it adds so much
mm-hmm.
to any exhibit, painting,
mm-hmm.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just brings it to life. And but that intrusive aspect.
Yeah.
Is
it's a little tough.
Can be an issue. So
right.
I don't, yeah,
some
I don't know.
Some people
if you,
don't like it.
I don't know if you could advertise in the within the ticket kind of,
mm-hmm.
or it's not tickets. It's yeah. How do you, I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
I don't know. And maybe it's not, maybe I'm being too picky.
No. I don't think that you're being picky. I think you bring up a very good point. And I think that's still like some of these little pieces
sure.
still need to be
kinks,
resolved. Yeah.
The, yeah.
Smooth them out.
Get all the wrinkles.
Smooth it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get out the iron.
I can see Rick smiling. Well, I can't wait to see the exhibit. Just.
Well, and there will be a preview for you all on October 6th, on opening night. We will open the exhibit early for you guys at 4 p.m.
Okay.
And so it'll be invite only the people that are loaning and people that have sat for these oral histories will be at this preview,
okay.
just so you guys can
no
have
guests,
some time.
No guests allowed.
I mean, you can bring a guest if you want.
Okay.
But then at 5, we'll open it up to members, and then at 6, it'll be open to the public.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as far as photos, is everything going to be on walls? Just thus far, there will be no cases.
There will be cases.
Yes. Because you talked about.
We were thinking about digitizing a bunch of things and putting them in iPads, but I was like, ew, no.
No.
So we'll have two archival cases with some letters, and then we'll also have a case with Rick's tools.
Right.
And some sketches of his. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. His sketches.
Yeah.
God, that just remembered all that.
Yeah.
That's what I remember, his sketches.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
They're very frenetic.
Yeah.
And his circles of different things and saying like, yes, but modify this. And
And it was all very fast. And well, again, he didn't know what direction it was going to take him in until he was actually
doing it
half the time.
Yeah.
You know, which is, that was exciting.
Yeah.
It was always fun to, when he would show me how to do things and I was a little intimidated, I think, you know,
yeah.
But it was always fun to try to do my own thing, but to watch him, I was happy watching him too.
Yeah.
Because I was always learning.
Yeah.
You know.
Always and, something new.
Yeah. It was always something new and fun and just easy. I mean, you know, just let's do this. Let's do that. Let's try, you know, something. Let's go get a beer.
Let's go get a beer.
Yeah.
So. Get a beer and try something. Why not?
Yeah.
A little bit of both.
Exactly. So
get you all lubed up, loosened up.
Really? Then go
try
back,
something
go
new.
Back there.
Yeah.
Hey, you got the right idea.
Well, Christina, thank you. And I'm gonna talk into the microphone. We're gonna talk into the microphone again. So it is now 12:45 p.m. and we will be concluding the interview, and transcript will be forthcoming.